Good morning. It's 8:14. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My first guest this morning is the County Waste Superintendent, Tim Loveday. He is here to talk about the landfill and the episode where a lot of dead deer were found around the site and plastic bags. Thanks for coming by, Tim. Welcome.
Good morning.
So before this winter, have we seen anything like this before? How many deer carcasses did we find out there?
DWR went out and searched the property between the landfill and the main road 32 that runs by Rockport Reservoir, and they found 27 carcasses total through there. Of those 27 carcasses, they determined that 13 had ingested plastic. There was plastic remaining in those carcasses.
So half, basically. Half. What does that mean about the other deer? And how could they have ingested trash as well, but it just didn't show up in the autopsies?
They could, because you know those deer come in and out of the landfill through the course of the winter, particularly when we have snow on the ground. It's a situation where this is not a new event. We have deer die-offs every year. That's a wintering grounds for them, and so we end up with particularly the first year deer dying off and on the mountain there. And most winters, when the snow is heavy, we'll have them come in while we're working and attempt to eat garbage. They're not getting garbage that's blowing litter. What they're doing is coming into the waste mast itself a lot of times while the equipment is running, and they're just looking for scraps. And if a plastic bag has residual on it from being in a garbage truck or had food in it or something, they eat that as if it was food. But I've had a lot of folks say, hey, why would a deer eat plastic? But, when you're starving to death and you've got nothing else to eat, if it smells good, you tend to eat it.
Sure. Have we seen anything else like this in other areas of the state or this
region? That kind of gets beyond solid waste, which is where my expertise is. But, you can go down to like near Echo State Park and the hill above there. They counted over 50 dead deer there that aren't anywhere near the landfill. This is a countywide problem and an intermountain throughout the Wasatch back that where these things gather. We had a lot of deer born. Most of the statistics say that the state raised about 9,000 head of deer this year in 2018. And so going into the winter, we had a lot of young ones. Around Three Mile Canyon, most of the deer that died were young does. I personally didn't see any large deer that didn't make it. But if you haven't seen that and you walk up on it, it's a disturbing sight. Our guys that work there, they kind of get attached to these herds that wander around the landfill. So it's not an easy thing to watch.
Yeah. What do we typically do to fend off animals from the landfill?
The only line of defense we have at Three Mile right now is daily cover, and that's where we cover the garbage with soil at the end of each day. If you get a heavy cover on there, that can defend during the night. But these things were coming in typically around 3:30 in the afternoon, and we historically don't put the cover on until 5 to 5:30 at the end of the day. So literally, you have to bump them with the equipment to get them away from the garbage. The guys can literally stick their hands out the window of the equipment and pet deer. I mean, it's just amazing to see. It's a beautiful sight, when they're healthy, but when they start starving, it's a whole different ballgame.
Just nearly domesticated if they're just not even afraid.
They're not afraid.
No. So there's been some talk I read that maybe you're putting clay down. Is that something that is more effective?
Yeah, we're working with DWR, and they had asked us to develop a better operations plan on how we might mitigate the access to the garbage. So historically, what we've done is put a we'll call it a gray material. It's basically ground shale. It's a light powdery material that can be dug through a little easier and that kind of thing. So what we're doing now is we have switched over the last 3 weeks to using on-site soils that we're excavating, and those tend to be clays and silts and rock that are a lot heavier, and they're cohesive, so they don't wash away, they don't blow away, and they're very difficult to dig through. For right now, that's solved our deer problem. the real test will come next winter when the snow flies.
Yeah, and when there's less food around.
Absolutely.
Right now there's lots to eat, I guess. So let's talk about plastic bags. Is it determined that those plastic bags were the cause of death for those deer, or is that just too hard to tell? I mean,
it was too hard to tell. DWR came in. They sent a biologist out to evaluate that. What their veterinarian told them is they would have to have a deer carcass that had died within, you know, a few days. These that they found all died in January, February range.
Oh,
so
okay.
Impossible to tell whether the plastics contributed to those deaths or not. You know, from our standpoint, from an operation standpoint, frankly, that doesn't matter to us right now. We just want to mitigate their access so we don't have this problem in the future.
Yeah, so how much plastic is there out there?
You know, we take in 42,000 tons a year of garbage, and a very significant percentage of that is plastic. Plastic bags particularly are the bane of any landfill operation, whether ours or anyone else's. We're in a situation where when that's ejected from a garbage truck and the wind's blowing, and, you know, we often have 40 or 50 mile an hour winds on top of that landfill, the second those plastics leave that truck, they're blowing, and we can't control that. So, you know, literally over the last week, we've spent over 250 labor hours just recovering plastic bags that have blown onto our property and adjacent property. So the county's big focus now, and we've actually been working on this for a long time. You know, last fall, as we were going into budgeting for 2019, we requested money from council for a litter fencing so that we can try to capture that before it leaves our property. We had to finish our brand new cell before we could put that fence up, but we got that permit from DEQ last week. And so we'll be moving forward now with installing a litter fence, and that will help mitigate a lot of the blowing plastic. So between the daily cover situation and the new fence, I think we'll see a pretty significant improvement over the next couple of months.
And does the litter fence also keep animals out of the area, or not so much?
No, the litter fence is designed, it's not a continuous fence around the landfill. You just put that on the downwind side, and that's what we have budget for this year. You know, there's been a lot of comment from the public about putting a fence around the entire landfill, and that's something we may consider, particularly as we continue working with DWR and what their recommendations are going to be. But people have to realize that is a very, very expensive endeavor to put that. I mean, it's a large facility. So, and even if we put the fence up, it's not going to keep all the deer out.
Yeah.
They can clear a fence pretty easy.
Yeah, so just kind of to wrap up the plastic discussion, but it does seem like there used to be, like, every grocery store had a plastic recycling bin. I don't feel like that's there anymore. As part of your job, I mean, you guys see it every single day. Are you petitioning our officials and, you know, people in the community to get control of this?
Yeah, plastics are a really difficult subject, and unfortunately that situation is getting worse, not better. We're in a situation right now, and to be quite honest, what I have pushed our council for in Summit County since I've taken the job is diversion to create more airspace within the landfill. The plastics themselves, those plastic bags, don't take up much space in a landfill, even though they're a absolute pain to deal with from a management standpoint. So we haven't really focused on, you know, trying to curb that at this point. You know, that may change in the future. But the real problem with the plastic bags is, you know, you're not supposed to put them in your commingled recycle anymore. You know, a few years ago, we could just put them in our curbside collection, and, you know, it never made it to the landfill. But now those plastic bags are not well received at the municipal recycling facilities or material recovery facilities. And that's a situation. You know, people think when we send our curbside and our other recyclables down to Salt Lake that they're being recycled. That's not really the case of what's going on. What we're doing is transporting those recyclables to a broker. And that broker sorts through all that garbage. And then they pick out what they think they can sell. And then they sell it to somebody who is a recycler. You know, they're just a broker. That's where that's going. And that's a misconception that's out there. Well, plastic bags cost those MRFs a lot of money. You know, I'm being told from our recycler broker down there that we're talking $200,000, $250,000 a year in downtime in dealing with plastic bags in a market that already is extremely down for recyclables. So they don't want to see plastic bags. And if you look around, you know, outside of Summit County down into the valley, some municipalities have already banned plastic bags from going in their recyclables. So yes, it's getting very difficult to get rid of any type of film plastic, whether plastic bags, Ziploc bags, you know, any kind of a food container like that.
Hmm. Okay. Do other communities have, you know, facilities set up, dispersed throughout their community? I mean, it just seems like this is something that could be, you know, with a little bit of will, political will, and perhaps a little bit of money, it could be addressed and had a significant impact on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, plastic bags, that's become more of a political discussion in recent years than an environmental discussion. But I think we need to circle back around on that a bit and take a hard look at what's really going on. You know, we're in a situation where it's not that those bags are not recyclable. It's the method of commingling our stream where we got everything mixed together. So there are places where you can take those bags, you know, Recycle Utah or Smith's, and those are just bags. And if it's just bags and you know what you're dealing with, there are people who will take those and recycle them. It's expensive. You know, that's become the big push with the whole recycle industry is it's all about making money when you get to the broker end of that kind of thing. They're not doing this for the good of the earth or kind of thing. They've got to be able to make money, and so those plastic bags are causing them not to make money. So we need to do a better job of collecting those at a single source. Take them to Smith's, take them to Recycle Utah, and you know they can handle those. They go back and they can make Trex decking, you know, stuff like that. You know, there are uses for them. One of the really confusing things amongst recycle right now is that I'm having to tell particularly young people that come to visit the landfill, yes, this item is technically recyclable, but we can't take it in our co-mingled stream because nobody wants it if it's mixed. And that's a big challenge to try to get that information out to the public.
Yeah, sure. So let's talk about the new cell. We're pretty much full in the existing cell. Is that correct?
And yeah, we ran out of room about a year ago.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, we've been really pressed to get into this new cell. This new cell is pretty exciting. It's a huge step forward for Summit County. You know, historically, in our current cell that we're operating in, it's unlined. So there's no leachate containment that just ultimately infiltrates into groundwater. We're monitoring groundwater to make sure we're not having a negative impact, but it's unlined, so eventually there will be an impact. The new cell has a geocomposite liner. It's essentially, it has a clay liner, and then on top of that clay liner is a high-density polyethylene 60 mil thick piece of plastic. It's a very thick piece of plastic. So that's a double liner system. And on top of that liner, we have leachate collection piping and a drainage layer. So all that leachate now will go to a pond where we can evaporate it or put it back on waste to make the waste decay faster. So just a much more environmentally friendly situation. Now that cell that we're currently building, cell one, should last the county about 7 years. So about 5 years from now, we'll start work on the next cell, cell two. In the meantime, we've got a little bit more buttoning up there to do to be able to get access into that cell to start using it.
To the new one. Okay.
But over the next month or so, we'll complete that, and by midsummer, we'll be into that new cell.
Okay. So July, August type
July,
of thing.
July, August. Yes.
Okay. Now, so you've sort of explained some of the technical differences, and I presume that technical part of managing waste is always being researched. And what do you see happening for the future? I mean, is there something even bigger down the road that's going to help digest what's in there and that kind of thing? Or
yeah, the way the technology associated with solid waste has been kind of a conundrum for me over the years. I started in the waste business when I got out of college in 1990. And, you know, frankly, through the 90s, I started looking for other things to do, with a geology degree, because I thought we'd be out of the waste business. The reality is the technology hasn't changed. Here we are 30 years later doing essentially the same thing that we were doing then. And in the case of the Intermountain West, we're doing what we were doing 30 years ago, because most of these landfills are still not even lined. So we're fixing that. But waste to energy is still the grand hope that we're all working towards. The technology is there now, and Summit County has been very active in monitoring that. We've even had a member of council go and look at those facilities. The problem is the cost is still not manageable for a small county. You know, to a waste energy facility in Summit County, the reality is it would cost us about $40 million to do something like that, and that's just not obtainable for the size county we are right now. But it keeps getting better. It's just been a slow mover. And frankly, in Utah and the Intermountain, there's not a big incentive because disposal is cheap. We're the second cheapest state on tipping fees. We're running on average, somewhere in that $30 a ton range. If we were having to pay $75 to $100 a ton, then waste energy looks a lot more attractive. So we're going to see some changes there over the next few years. There's a few companies coming out now with some pilot plants. You know, there's been a lot of talk of waste energy over the last decade, but when you sit down with these folks, they've never actually built anything. And that drives me crazy because they're trying to sell something they've never seen. And, that falls under the snake oil deal. But there are companies now, particularly working with the Department of Defense, who have pilot projects. And those are the ones we're really watching now. So we're well aware of the changes in the industry. We're monitoring those. And, at some point, I'm in hopes that we'll see in the not-too-distant future a better means of handling waste. Right now, our best defense, we got a landfill and we got to recycle, we got to divert, stop throwing stuff away that's usable and, try to minimize your packaging. Amazon and those type mail order places are driving me crazy because it's a box and a box and a box and lots of plastic, lots of cardboard. So we're got to deal with what's in front of us, but there is hope on the horizon.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Anything else you want to say about the projects going on out there? How many people do you have working out at the...
We've got 8 people in the solid waste division that are busy, and then we pull in temporary help on occasion for litter control. Community service comes out and helps us out occasionally, and we really appreciate that because, we operate on a thread most of the time. We just barely have enough to cover. So when anything goes wrong, we're short-staffed. But a lot of improvements have been made. We've had tremendous support the last couple of years from council and from the county management. And so our budgets are better. We've got great equipment. We've built this new cell. We're training our staff to operate that. So we're pretty excited about the way things look for the next year.
Okay. Thanks for this update.
Thank you.
Tim Loveday. He is the county waste superintendent. Thanks for joining us. Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. And my next guests are Bruce Erickson and Hannah Tyler from the Park City Planning Department. Bruce is the planning director, and Hannah Tyler with us is a planner with the department. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So, Hannah, let's talk about Woodside Park Phase 2 housing development. And it's been keeping your department very busy. You're presenting on phase one this week. The city is the applicant, and they're asking for modifications to the project's master plan development and plat, and removing a condition of approval that an e-bike station be located on the site. And it looks like the transportation department has determined there's no need for the e-bike station at this point.
Yes, that is correct. So when this project went through the process, I believe it was in 2017, the Planning Commission added a condition of approval requiring an electric bike station like the Summit Bike Share stations be installed within the project boundary. The issue is that there's not enough room for those. I think all of us are familiar with that, and that those are pretty large units. And so the affordable housing team worked with the transportation planning department and determined that there is a new Summit Bike Share station going at City Park. And so because of that close proximity, they think that the need for a bike share station in that location will be satisfied by that new City Park station. And so what they're requesting is that condition of approval be removed from the master plan development and the condo plat.
Okay.
Go into the other one. So the bike station will go into Woodside Park Phase 2, not Woodside Park Phase 1.
Okay.
Not
okay.
anymore.
Okay. And so there will be...
No. I misspoke. My understanding was we were going to try and do something on the Woodside Park Phase 2, but Hannah tells me that I misunderstood. So nothing in Phase 2.
Yeah, there will be no e-bike station in Phase 2. We'll have bike racks in both, Phase 1 and Phase 2. We'll have bike racks so you could lock your bike up, but there will not be an e-bike station just because they're so big. And that proximity to the city park, we think there actually won't be a need because you'll be able to get over there and get them. So.
Okay. And Phase 1 and Phase 2 are just adjacent,
correct? They're right across the street from
each
other.
Okay. Yeah, so it wouldn't be necessary then. So where is the city at in terms of the appeal process for the master plan development for Phase 2?
So you're correct. Phase 2 has been appealed, and that has been scheduled for the Board of Adjustment on June 25th. And so we're kind of just in a holding period until we hit that meeting.
So help us understand, what does that mean that it's going to the Board of Adjustment?
So a neighbor has appealed the project, and so the Board of Adjustment will be reviewing the merits of that appeal and making a decision as to whether or not the Planning Commission erred in that decision or not. And so, as you're aware, Planning Commission approved it, and so that's what's under consideration with the Board of Adjustment.
And why has Phase 2 drawn so much attention and Phase 1 not so much?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's a city project. A lot of it has to do with the fact that while it is underneath what the zone density would allow, it is consistent with the zone in that area. And so the neighbors are kind of watching and making sure that everything is consistent with the zoning. There are some discussions about how the master plan development was applied, and the Board of Adjustment is an independent body to make that decision.
Okay, and who makes up the Board of Adjustment?
There are four members of the public. I don't have their names right in front of me right now. Okay. Five members, excuse me.
Okay. And how often do appeals go to the Board? Do they always go to the Board of Adjustment?
It depends on what's being appealed. If I make a decision, it goes to the Planning Commission. Planning Commission makes a decision, it goes to the Board of Adjustment. And the Board of Adjustment is designed to be independent. They meet five or six times a year to review these appeal matters and make sure, fundamentally, their job is to make sure the rules were applied correctly and that whoever was making the decision did not misapply.
Okay, and what is the rule that's actually being contested?
So there's a couple different aspects to the appeal itself, but one being which section of the code applies, whether it's the standard master plan development section or the affordable housing master plan development section. And so that's really kind of the crux of the issue. And so I think the Board of Adjustment will review that and sort of determine whether or not the appropriate section of code was applied.
Okay. And just for people new to this story, how many units are we talking about?
So there are 58 units in the project. 52 of them would be deed restricted affordable housing.
Okay. Okay. So Bruce, it looks like the city's taking the next step with the Treasure Hill purchase by rezoning it to recreation and open space. And where is it zoned now? What's the zone now?
Okay, so in the original Sweeney Master Plan, these two parcels were zoned for development under the master plan. And they were originally a state MPD, and all the density was stripped off the rest of the mountain and put into these two little parcels on either end. And if you remember the treasure discussions, there were two pods. One was the Creole Gulch, and the other one was the end of Empire Avenue. And what we're doing is taking the next step and rezoning them now to recreation open space, which is what the rest of the mountain is.
Okay, and what does that allow?
Recreation open space allows... It does not allow for development generally, but it will allow for trails and skiing and the ski lift, walking, biking, those kind of things.
And do we anticipate that there'll be a ski lift in there?
Well, we've got the town lift, and the town lift goes
through.
Okay. And I would expect the resort to have a look at how that skiing operates over the next couple of years, and then they're going to have a discussion with the city because the city's the property owner.
Okay. And what about a conservation easement? Does that also get laid down in that process, or?
I think we're looking at doing a conservation easement up there. I think the conservation values need to be established and how we accomplish that.
Okay. And where does that begin? Is that
It starts with our shop and the city attorney's office.
Okay. Okay, great. Let's talk about the Park City Heights housing project, and that's on the planning agenda again, I guess, this week. It's been in the works since 2010, and there have been a lot of amendments, a lot of extensions. What's being considered right now?
So in this case, this is the next phase of Park City Heights, and they're adjusting their phasing plan to add one additional affordable housing unit in this phase and removing it from phase five. And the reason you keep seeing this is this project is generally consistent with all the other master plans you see. You see them coming forward in phases that are sort of rational. So you don't see somebody going out there and building 279 lots and then selling them out over the next 10 years, right? That's the old way of doing it. The new way of doing it is looking at your market, delivering just the product at the right time, and making sure you're consistent with your affordable housing requirements. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this is standard procedure other than shifting the phasing plan to add one additional unit in this phase.
Oh, okay. And how much of this project is built at this point?
With phase four, we're going to be right around 60%.
60%, okay. And what, about 10 phases?
Oh, no. Five or six is the last phase.
Oh, okay. Okay, and we're in phase four at this point.
Right.
And how many affordable units are out in this?
I believe 78, but I could be wrong.
78, and I'm sorry, give me the total number again.
279,
278, yeah. Okay, okay. And this was under the care of planner Kirsten Whetstone, who's moved on to a new job with Summit County. Who's taking over this project?
We were aware Kirsten was going to go to Summit County, and so we transitioned it over to Planner Astorga. Planner Astorga has taken a new position as the planning director down in Bountiful. So at this point, I have to reassign the project. We have a new planner coming on board the 24th of June, and I expect that that planner will take this project over. In the meantime, Hannah and I will share it.
Okay. Just add that to your list.
I guess the message going out, Carolyn, is that, you know, we're doing our best to get through this little period of time, and I appreciate all the generosity of the public and the courtesy of us trying to work through all these things. We have a new historic district planner that's helping Hannah out. We have a new land use policy planner that's helping out. Her role is primarily writing code and taking some of the land management code pressures off of us, and she'll be updating the housing code as soon as we get through a couple of these little issues. We also have a new office manager and, like I say, one new planner on the 24th of June. So we'll be fully back up to speed by the 1st of July.
How hard is it to find planners these days?
It's a lot easier to lose them than it is to find them. We did a nationwide recruitment for all of our folks. Our historic district planner comes to us from Ball State University. Our land use policy planner has a law degree and a master's in planning. She comes to us from the University of Utah. The new planner coming in June will be coming from Newton, Massachusetts, where she has 14 villages under her jurisdiction at this point. And so she's coming along. So, you know, for a planner, personnel matters are kind of difficult. We'd rather deal with the land management code, but I think we've got a really strong team right now.
Okay. You're fully loaded, ready to go.
Well, we're going. Irrespective of whether we're ready, we're going.
Okay. Let me just ask about the amendment to the land management code regarding setbacks, and that's also going before the Planning Commission. And your team, Bruce, has been working on this for a long time to clean up the land management code. Can you tell us the issues that are existing there?
This one is just completely classic land management code stuff. When the last edit of the land management code happened, two sentences were deleted from a section of the code on how to do setbacks in the single family zone. So, especially in Prospector. So in the course of moving the code through the Planning Commission and then the City Council and then getting it codified, those two sentences were deleted. So there's no regulation at this point. The code is just wrong. So Francisco is just cleaning that little section up for Prospector.
Okay. So it's not going to look necessarily very different as
no,
far as
you'll
setbacks.
See two or new sentences that do what they're supposed to.
Okay. Great. And it's a pretty easy fix then.
Oh, yeah.
Shouldn't be anything big. Hannah, anything else you want to talk about projects are you working on and issues?
No, I think we're just trying to plow forward and make sure we're training everyone up to speed and so we can push forward the rest of these projects.
Okay, great. Bruce, anything else?
No, I'm all set. Thank you, Carolyn.
Okay, thanks so much for coming in. My final guest this morning is Reagan Archibald. He is on the line to talk to us about East-West Health and Functional Medicine and the Lunch and Learn being held at the Mark tomorrow. Good morning, Reagan. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's start off. What is East-West Health? What is this organization?
We are a group of both Eastern-trained medical providers and Western-trained medical providers who practice functional and regenerative medicine, but are really looking to get to the root cause of patients' health conditions.
What is functional medicine?
So functional medicine is where you look at the way that the body is manifesting itself, either through symptoms or through labs and testing. And so we use functional medicine as an avenue to take a step back and look deeper into all of the actions that the body's performing and then optimize the health of an individual by correcting those imbalances that we discover in the testing that we do.
Okay, so you're going to be talking about gut health, autoimmune illnesses, and thyroid health specifically, my understanding is, tomorrow. Can you give us maybe some examples of how that functional medicine application fits with, let's say, gut health?
Well, if you, the typical pathway of someone that's struggling with, like, IBS, maybe they've got bloating, they've got constipation, they're achy all the time, their hair is falling out, they just don't quite feel like themselves. And you go to your doctor and your doctor says, well, everything looks normal in your lab. Let's try this medication. And you just end up getting a prescription but not getting the result. What functional medicine does is we take a step back and we'll say, well, what could be causing the IBS in the first place? And typically we'll discover that there is this relationship between the hormones in your body and the diversity of the bacteria in your gut. And so we will, look at particular patterns through our functional medicine lens. And by looking at that, we'll be able to uncover that maybe they've got small intestine bacterial overgrowth, or maybe there's some type of chemical toxicity in their body that is keeping their body from really optimizing itself. And through our functional testing, we will uncover that and help get a patient on the right path. And then our health coaches are there on the back end to help support them through this. But tomorrow, we will be talking all about the connection of hormones, digestive health, and the immune system, and how it is the biggest mystery and secret in healthcare right now.
Yeah, so what, let's take either of those conditions. What typically are the treatments, let's say, for, digestive issues? I mean, there must be just some, you go to your doctor and they give you medicine. What do they give you? Pepto-Bismol? What happens there?
Yeah, it could be Pepto-Bismol. It could be, Omeprazole is one of the most commonly prescribed prescription drugs right now, and that's basically a drug called a proton pump inhibitor, and so it stops the production of stomach acid. And once you stop the production of stomach acids, either with omeprazole or maybe Tagamet or an acid blocker, what happens is your food does not get digested properly in your stomach. And by the time it hits your small intestine, you want those proteins to be denatured and starting to be digested. But if you have fermented food that hits your small intestine, then that's where people start to get overgrowth of bacteria and fungus. And it can lead to a variety of symptoms. It can lead to fatigue, fibromyalgia. It can lead to brain fog, hair falling out, joints aching because it triggers an immune response when you've got an infection. But that infection, once we are able to test it, it's actually a breath test is one of the tests we use, and then a stool test is another one along with a blood test. And once we can uncover exactly what the cause is, then that's where the treatments come into place. And so it's really hard to define exactly what the treatment looks like. until we have a clear picture of what is going on at the body. But it's a completely different way of analyzing it. You know, instead of treating symptoms, which is what, you know, I found that most clinics do, we want to go after the cause and actually understand what the mechanism is behind the symptoms that someone's manifesting with.
Yeah. So how does lifestyle and choices there play a role in this?
I think it's massive. I you know, we can't put enough emphasis on that. That's why, you know, we are great. All the doctors at East West Health, and we are great at diagnosing, but then the lifestyle medicine is the key component, and that's where we have a health coach that we use, and our health coaches, they put you through a step-by-step process. They help you with your grocery list. They help you get the right foods in your diet. They help you prepare for the week and plan things out. We put the right fitness and exercise program together based on what your labs show us. And then we have a whole educational curriculum that we take our patients through that really, you know, our goal is to help people have their health independence. And so we feel like we give as complete of a picture as we possibly can in that process. And we make it fun, too.
So why did you pick the three areas, gut health, autoimmune, and thyroid health? Why those three areas to focus on for tomorrow's Lunch and Learn?
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize is the thyroid is related directly to the health of your gut and vice versa. If you don't have thyroid hormone, you're not going to have good peristalsis in your gut. And the autoimmune component is what is triggered when you have a breach in some of the intestinal integrity. And so what can happen is you get either a bacterial overgrowth that's not friendly to your body or a yeast overgrowth. Your body's immune system is going to be triggered by that. And when your body's immune system is triggered by an infection in your gut, it actually goes and starts looking for all the areas in your body that could be threatened. And most of us, if we've had an old injury in a joint, that's why your knees could start aching or your back could start aching. And so what we found is if we can put all these pieces together with the thyroid, with the gut, and autoimmunity, that's where we can give people a much more complete picture of their health. And they have symptoms that have been with them for years that get resolved because of this kind of overall approach and philosophy.
Hmm. Okay, and where do you practice, Reagan? Where is your...
So our Park City Clinic is just off Sun Peak Drive, and so we're right behind the Keller Williams building, and I'm here. I'm one of the licensed acupuncturists. We've also got Dr. John Lawrence. He's our medical doctor. Nicole Dreyer is another acupuncturist, and she's our gut specialist. And then we've got Devin Thomas, who's our nurse practitioner, and Aaron Kay, who's our health coach. And we are on 1790 Sun Peak Drive.
Okay. And then for tomorrow's event, let's get the details. It starts at noon. It's at the Mark.
Yep.
And do people need...
It will be at the Mark tomorrow at 12 o'clock. The event will be from 12 to 1. Everybody who comes will get a copy of my newest book called Your Healthy Self. And it's a book that's all about optimizing health and living a long, healthy life. And so everyone will get a copy of that, and then they'll get a chance to come and meet with Dr. Lawrence or Devin Thomas for their initial medical consultation.
Okay, great. Anything else you want to say?
No, really. I think if you are someone who's struggling to find answers for your health, and looking for a new opportunity to feel better, look better, experience life with more joy, then don't miss this event.
Thank you. That's Reagan Archibald from East West Health, and he'll be hosting the Lunch and Learn at the Mark tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.